Cabinet of Curiosities by James Henry. Chapter 1. The train shook a little, and Rosa Dew awoke to find her right foot tangled up in the carrier bag. Bending down to free herself, she cast a subtle look around to see if she was alone. Had she spoken or even cried out in her sleep? Fortunately, the carriage was empty, except for the conductor slowly making his way towards her, occasionally reaching out to a tattered headrest for support as the train lurched and rattled complainingly. Rosa sat very still, staring straight out of the window as though trying to turn herself invisible. There was very little to see, just fields, growing darker as afternoon turned into evening. She clearly hadn't become invisible anyway, because the conductor nodded at her and sat down in the seat opposite. "No ticket, I suppose." Rosa shook her head. The conductor scratched a long nose with a long finger and heaved a long sigh. Rosa couldn't help noticing the odd colour of the lank hair sticking out from under his cap. It was mostly grey, but with an almost greenish tinge. He clapped his hands together suddenly, making her jump in her seat. "You'll be wanting to murder me, then," said the conductor. He looked almost pleased at the idea, rubbing his long hands together thoughtfully. "That's your plan, murder me, and take my ticket machine and my money, and go on a spending spree to Margate." Rosa didn't even know where Margate was. "No, I didn't really plan to get on the train. I'm just sort of here." "Ah," said the conductor wisely, "drugs." "No," said Rosa, "not drugs. Look, I'll get off at the next station. You don't need to call the police or anything. Honestly, I'm really sorry." The conductor looked at her for a long while, as though somehow weighing her. Rosa looked straight back. His eyes were bright green. Maybe she was a little overdressed for a train journey. Was that why he was staring? Rosa wondered. She was wearing purple suede boots, a green flared skirt with little mirrors running round it in the complicated pattern, a pink shirt covered by a black jumper that was more holes than jumper, the entire ensemble wrapped in an ankle-length cream coat with thick fake fur cuffs and collar, topped off with a wide-brimmed green hat, a green feather sticking jauntily out of the band. Peeking out of her strawberry-patterned handbag was an oversized pair of silver sunglasses with rims shaped like stars. She was glad she hadn't put those on. It might have looked a bit much. The train was slowing now as it came into the next station. "Anyone worrying about you at home?" the conductor asked suddenly. Rosa tried to think of a single person who might be missing her and couldn't, which was odd, but then she'd only just woken up. Her memory was bound to be a little bit fuzzy. "I don't think so," she said. "I haven't run away, if that's what you mean, and I don't have any money. But if you give me your address, I'll send you the price of the ticket as soon as I can." Then, through the half-open carriage window, she smelled something she'd never smelled before, but recognised straight away. The sea. Somehow she knew this is where she had to get off. The train stopped, and the conductor looked at her for a second longer, then swung out the carriage door and stood back. "Go on," he said, his face turning miserable again. "Out you get. Probably lose my job over this. Have to tell him you turned nasty and overpowered me." Rosa picked up her bag and climbed down onto the platform. The conductor swung the door shut and bent his tall frame down to look sadly out of the window after her. "I hope you don't lose your job," she said. The conductor shrugged and the train started to slowly pull away. Rosa walked along the station platform. The small ticket office was closed. A sign swung slowly, creaking in the breeze. "Warmington," she read to herself, then turned, hearing a shout. The train was picking up speed now, but the conductor was leaning out of the window, waving something at her. Breaking into a run, Rose was just able to catch up enough for him to thrust a £5 note into her hand before she ran out of platform. "I'll tell him you had a gun," he yelled, and then he called something else out, but the engine was too noisy now. Rosa stopped and waved at the conductor, and he waved back once. The train went over a level crossing, disappearing into the darkness, and suddenly all she could think about was how tired and cold and hungry she was. Chapter 2. According to the large map on the wall, Warmington Station was partway up a hill on the very edge of the town itself. If Rosa continued uphill and onto the main road, she would have to walk for another 6 miles before reaching the next town. So she went downhill towards Warmington. There might at least be somewhere open to buy food. It took Rosa a little over 5 minutes before she was in the high street. In that time, she was passed by only one car. It was long, silver grey and sleek, and although it looked old in design, the engine purred and whispered as though it were brand new. Luggage was bundled up at the rear, and the windows were blacked out. As the car slid by, Rosa thought of underwater creatures like sharks and large, hungry eels, and she shivered. As she walked through Warmington, Rosa passed newsagents and record shops and clothes stores, but they were all closed. One pub was open, next to the War Memorial. Its door was slightly ajar, and she could just make out a sliver of warm orange light and quiet conversation, the low, insistent beeping of a fruit machine. But she knew she was too young to go in. From somewhere further in town, a sharp, greasy smell was making her mouth water. So she kept going, putting one foot in front of the other. And there, right through town and on the seafront it was, a solitary fish and chip shop, still open. Rosa headed towards its welcoming lights, only noticing at the last minute that the entrance was blocked by a thin-faced boy in a tracksuit, swigging from a can of drink. There was a woman behind the counter, staring at a badly flickering television, on which a quiz show contestant was trying to answer a particularly difficult question. "Excuse me," said Rosa politely. The youth ignored her. He had pale skin, marked with the craters of old spots and the red pox of a fresh crop. Rosa tried again. "Excuse," without looking at her, he spat out a long stream of brown liquid that fizzed and spattered on the tiled floor. It missed the toes of her boots, but only just. Rosa stood in frozen silence for a second. "What did they say?" she thought, utterly bewildered. But the moment was broken by the tinny sound of applause from the television, and the boy pushed past her and sauntered out of the shop. Rosa stared after him. The woman shouted something, but the boy had already gone, so she turned her glare on Rosa instead. "He's barred," she said, arms crossed. "Don't tell me you want as many chips you can get for 15p, or 17, or 22, or you're barred and all." After showing the woman her note, and receiving a grunt of acknowledgement in return, Rosa bought a pasty. "Watch them seagulls," the woman advised. "These buggers for pasties. A kind of tree." Rosa found this last sentence particularly enigmatic. It wasn't until she was sitting huddled in a seafront bus shelter that she realised the woman had been talking to the television. The pasty was large and surprisingly hot, so Rosa just ate half, wrapping the rest for later, and letting it glow warmly in her lap as she watched the sun set over the water. Tiny waves slapped against the pebbly beach before being sucked back again, almost apologetically. "Nice view, innit?" The boy from the chip shop was standing next to her. She hadn't heard him walk up to her, or the two other boys, dressed in identical tracksuits, standing behind him. "Very nice?" Rosa stood, instinctively knowing not to let herself get surrounded. "Very nice?" One of the other boys was slightly taller, and it was he who was mocking Rosa, talking in a silly, high-pitched lisp, which didn't sound even vaguely like her. Rosa started to walk away, heading back into town, but they moved quickly into a line, blocking her way. "We want to borrow some money," said the first boy, and again he was staring just past her. Rosa wondered for a moment if he was short-sighted, and then she realised, this is something he's learned, a way to intimidate people by telling them you weren't even worth looking at. "Yeah," said the taller boy, "we want some ginger beer, innit?" The shorter boy, who hadn't spoken yet, laughed, an uncontrolled, slightly hysterical sound. "Yeah," he said, "lashings of it." They were all sniggering now, but watching her carefully to see what she would do. "I'm sorry," said Rosa, and tried to walk past them. They stopped laughing instantly, and the first boy shot out a hand, grabbing her arm. This is bad, she thought, but her fear gave her a burst of confidence, and she kicked him in the shin very hard, then ran, not looking back, even as she heard him hit the ground, squealing in pain. Chapter 3. Shouts and swearing told Rosa the youth were seconds behind her. An alley entrance was just visible in the darkness, so she darted into it and took a left, then a right, trying to avoid circling round and running back into her pursuers. The footsteps behind her slowed, then stopped, the boys clearly confused by the twists and turns. Rosa was lightly built, and though her boots weren't designed for running, they at least had sensible heels. She started walking again, quickly and quietly, looking in vain for some side exit. There wasn't one, and worse, Rosa was starting to feel as though she were being in some way channeled. She breathed heavily now, and her legs were growing shaky. Around her were high walls, topped with vicious shards of broken glass, and iron gates too, which presumably led into people's back gardens, but none would open, even when she kicked them in frustration. Rosa's stomach rumbled, and she remembered the wrapped pasty in her hand, squashed but still warm. Ducking behind a battered old red van, she greedily tore into it. It was tasty, if a little salty, and she was already thirsty from all the running. Maybe somewhere a corner shop would be open. She probably had just enough money for a bottle of water. As she looked up, she saw the first boy, the one she kicked in the shin, standing in front of her, grinning triumphantly. He was leaning a little awkwardly on his bad leg, and looking directly at her now. His eyes were brilliant blue, Rosa noticed. He actually had quite nice eyes, which somehow made things worse. Even thinking about it later, Rosa had no idea why she threw the pasty at him. It wouldn't have hurt him, and it certainly wouldn't have distracted him for the time she needed to start running again. Maybe she just wanted to wipe that grin off his face for a second. For whatever reason, she threw it as hard as she could. It never hit him, although there was nothing wrong with her aim. Instead, a feathered blur appeared between them, and something small and winged snatched the food out of the air, barely a foot from the boy's face. The boy staggered back in shock. What stayed in Rosa's mind wasn't the look of surprise on his face, or the expressions of thuggish pleasure on the faces of the other boys, turning to shock as they rounded the corner. But her improvised weapon hadn't been snatched out of the air by a claw or a beak, but by a prehensile foot. The thing hovered in the air for a second. Though it was dark now, Rosa could see it wasn't a bird, it had the wrong shape entirely. The foot passed the morsel up to a pair of small, human-like hands, and the face turned itself to Rosa, bearing sharp teeth in what might have been a threat, or a warning, or even a triumphant smirk. A monkey? Wondered Rosa. By the time she'd even thought that monkeys don't have wings, the thing, whatever it was, had already flapped its wings and gone. While the boys were still staring, open-mouthed, Rosa seized her chance and ran. She hoped there'd be an unbolted door somewhere, or a space to hide, but instead there was just another alley, with a high brick wall on one side, and the green-stained glass panes of an ancient conservatory on the other, with not a door in sight. But she'd either taken the corner too fast, or her boots finally betrayed her, for she skidded and stumbled, tottering clumsily for a moment before her hand encountered one of the lower panes of glass, which shifted under her weight. She pushed the glass cleanly out of its frame, leaving a gap just big enough to fit through. Converting her stumble into a dive, she shot through the gap and over the glass, landing on her front in something soft and damp. There was just enough time for her to swiftly fit the pane back into place a second before the boys entered the alley. Their voices were cut off instantly, though she could still see their smeared shapes through the dirty glass. Chapter 4. Rosa watched as the boys looked around themselves stupidly. They must have decided she'd climbed the high wall, as after threatening gestures from their leader, they clambered onto a wheelie bin, one by one, scrambled up over it. She peered out of the glass for a long time, trying not to steam it up with her heavy, ragged breaths, but eventually the sound of their shouting died away altogether, and the boys were gone. Rosa had landed in what she thought might be a flower bed, although there were more moss and weeds than natural flowers. Ugh, she thought, and getting to her feet began brushing herself down. Her coat had a large green stain from her dive, and the rest of her clothes were looking distinctly the worse for wear. Her jumper was almost completely shredded. How had she mend something that was mostly holes to begin with, Rosa wondered. In the end, she just pulled at the wool, winding it round her hand and putting the ball in her coat pocket. There. How to take off a jumper without first taking off your coat, by Rosa Dew. A light came on with a plink. Rosa froze. But it was only a small, old-fashioned lamppost planted haphazardly in a patch of bare earth. Now there was light. Rosa could see the conservatory was larger than it had looked from the outside, much larger. There were overgrown shrubs here and small trees, and broad steps too, leading down into a large sunken area, the glass roof high above her head now. The further in Rosa went, idly touching leaves that seemed to reach out to her as she passed, the more it seemed like a small wood, hidden away under glass. From ahead she heard the tinkling of water. A dragonfly hung in the air in front of her for a second, eyes glowing like jewels, then shimmered and was gone. Nothing here was very well maintained. Spades and forks lay on their sides, ivy beginning to creep over them. Statues and large urns were shrouded with creepers. One large round object on a plinth, so covered in green leaves, it was impossible to make out at all. Rosa pulled away a great branch of ivy and uncovered an enormous skull, fully 3 feet high. She read a wooden sign on the plinth, giant, self, but the rest had rotted away. Rosa reached out and touched the skull's forehead. It was slightly rough, and when she tapped it with a nail, it rang hollow. There was a bird's nest in one of the eye sockets, though the birds themselves had left long ago. The skull was grinning. Not an unfriendly grin, though, thought Rosa. She let the ivy fall back to cover it once again. The sound of running water was louder now as Rosa travelled deeper into the garden. Following a path of broken, mossy paving stones, that led her eventually to a large fountain, which bubbled happily to itself. The water was clear, and she drank thirstily from her cupped hands. At first her teeth ached a little at the cold, although soon a warm glow spread through her. She splashed a little more on her face and looked around. The glass panels ran out against a brick wall here, and Rosa thought she'd finally found the house the conservatory was set against. Spotting a large wooden door, she quietly tried twisting the handle, but it was locked. No way out through here. Flakes of snow started to settle on the glass roof. That's that, then, she decided. No point heading out into the cold, dark night with no food and no idea where she was even going. Stay here tonight, then sneak back out in the morning. She wouldn't even have to sleep on the floor. A bench sat just out of sight from the door, a little back from the path. No one walking past the conservatory would ever see her. Carved into the bench's back were the words, "Donated by the Stanton family." Rosa ran her fingers over the carving, then lay down, tucking her bag under her head as a pillow and pulling her coat more tightly around her. Whoever the Stanton family were, thought Rosa, they made surprisingly comfortable benches.